Thanks for joining me today for episode 6 of our Confluence podcast, Preventing Behaviors That Challenge Us and Resources Available to Providers. I'm your host, Ruby Martin, Certification Services Bureau Director, and I'm joined by our co-host, right-hand man and division chief for Okdel Certification Services, Chris Luce. Hi, Chris. We also welcome a very special guest for this conversation, Stacy Kenny. Stacy, please, can you introduce yourself and describe your role for the Okdel team?
Hi, Ruby. I'm so excited to be here today for this conversation. I am a division chief for the Bureau of Early Intervention Services and Family Supports, and I oversee Eastern operations and monitoring, so all those Eastern EI programs, and also family supports in our Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Grant, but I'm here today with my EI hat on, so excited to be here.
Excellent. And EI, for those who might not know, is early intervention, correct? Awesome. Yeah.
Yes.
We always speak in acronyms here, and then we have to kind of slow down and remember that not everybody knows what we're saying. But thank you, Stacy, for being here. We're so happy. This topic, we hear daily from providers around the struggles that they're having now and in the last several years, basically more than ever with behaviors of young children in programs. So people are really struggling, unsure how to maintain safe environments for all the children when they're focused so much attention on one or two kids in their classrooms. These kids are really in need of additional support, whether it's on the prevention end or on the intervention end. So we're here to talk a lot about that today. We are also hearing providers that are unsure when to request that intervention and when behaviors are extra challenging and what are the areas in between. We discuss this a lot at Okdel and wanted to provide a discussion today that digs into helpful strategies and resources and processes that we can share with providers to help them during these challenging situations. So before we get into some of the resources and supports that Okdel does provide and are preparing to provide, I would love to start with a reminder of some of the preventative pieces that we need to make sure that are in place as providers if we want to successfully manage children's behavior in our environments. I consider myself an expert on this because I have spent so much time in the field as a professional running programs, but I also have done a mass amount of trainings and taught classes on this topic as well. So I've seen a lot of success in my own internal research, and I just want to share a lot of that with you today. So I think sometimes we have children join our classrooms, and whether start of the year or in the middle of the year as it progresses, we think this child needs to come in and adapt to our space to be successful. In early learning programs, our focus should always be on adapting our environments and practices to the individual needs of each child. We know that's challenging. And it's also very doable. So I'm going to give this over to Chris because he's facilitating today's discussion and will act as our interviewer. So go ahead, Chris, do your thing.
Thanks, Ruby, and welcome, Stacy. We hear from providers that children are sometimes out of control in these environments. What do you think is the most important thing providers can do to make sure children in their spaces are feeling safe and can manage their behaviors?
Great question, and a great one to start with. And according to my own research and in my own experience, this is hands down relationship building. Taking time, especially in those first 45 days when you're learning that child, to observe and work to develop relationships by truly honoring the child, their family, their culture, asking open-ended questions about their thoughts and experiences, getting to know why they are interested in things and what they are interested in just by watching them and listening to their play and their interactions. Showing the child that you trust them, and this helps you and the child to learn to respect and trust each other. The child will not learn or develop in a space with any provider that are not connected. They are not connected. This practice is essential, showing them that you value them by taking those interests the children have and make them part of the lesson plans, adapt the environment to meet their specific needs. For example, you know Tay is happiest when he's in the block center, and you try to get him to move or transition to another center, and he meets that with aggression or anger. Bringing those other learning experiences to him, providing him with paper and pencil or clipboard, a camera or other items to document his buildings, sharing with him blueprints to study and explore, providing books and magazines on construction. or woodworking, providing people and fabric and some items from dramatic play to create drama scenarios with his buildings. You then create a space where he is respected for his interests and passion, but you are also providing him with a varied experience to develop multiple layers of intellect. Stacey, this is probably something you hear and see a lot. Are any additional thoughts on this?
Yes, Ruby, you're so right. Relationship building is crucial to the creation of safe spaces for children to learn and grow. Additionally, concerns about behavior that is challenging that we hear about within our bureau sometimes stem from the child having difficulty communicating their wants and needs to the adults in their world. If the child is eligible for early intervention, the IFSP, which is Individualized Family Support Plan for kids ages 0 to 3, or IEP, which is Individualized Education Plan for kids 3 to 5, those teams can add strategies to support communication for the EI service provider to implement, and also coordinate and collaborate with the child care provider to implement strategies throughout the day. However, if the child's not eligible for EI, there are still some strategies that child care providers can implement with all children to support communication throughout the day. Having classroom picture cards or symbols available is really helpful for children to make requests or get their needs met when they just can't find the words that they want to use to meet those needs. Respond to the pictures, gestures, and body language just like you would verbal communication, because that is their form of communication. Yes, we want kids to learn to talk, but when they are on the verge of expressing challenging behaviors, is not the time to teach that. Make sure to honor all appropriate attempts at communications as much as possible. Other helpful strategies to support communication in order to prevent challenging behavior includes offering choices as much as possible and having a predictable and consistent routine, and consider using a picture schedule so that children can understand their day and learn to anticipate when their needs will be met. Finally, sometimes children have developmental delays or disabilities that lead to delays in communication, and social-emotional development at times can manifest in challenging behaviors. If you have concerns about the child's development, be sure to refer the child to your local early intervention infant toddler for 0 to 3 or preschool for 3 to 5 program for an evaluation.
We will talk more about that later. I just want to make sure that people stick around for it. Go ahead.
So, Ruby, I hear you talk a lot about providers and understanding the child's developing body. Can you put this into context?
Oh, the child's developing body. Sure thing. It's something that we need to honor, right? So when visiting programs, and in my own experience as a provider, so many times I hear people say to young children, use your walking feet or keep your feet on the floor. And although I truly appreciate the positive nature of these statements, the young child, and I'm talking toddlers and pre-K and even young schoolagers, really listen to their bodies and have an extreme need for activity. So their little bodies consistently give them signals to run, jump, swat, kick, hit, throw, and climb. And for some reason, the spaces we provide for them to be in for 9 to 12 hours every day do not contain many opportunities for these activities to happen. We must provide space for their development. It's so essential. Providing a place for them to stomp, dance, push against a wall, climb, rough and tumble safely, of course, hang upside down, or throw. Providers should be using language like, it looks like your body needs to climb. Come with me. The hollow blocks are available. Let's create a cool thing to climb on. Or, Haley, look at your body telling you it wants to throw. We have some balls in a basket we can throw into, or you can take those Duplo blocks that are spread on the floor and throw them into the bin one at a time. Come here and tell me your choice. This way, the child isn't feeling like they are in trouble or getting conflicting messages from the teachers for doing what their body wants. Also, in addition to regular outside playtime in the daily schedule, a great practice is to stop everything every 50 minutes or so and have a dance party or jumping jacks or run in place or stretch, anything that provides children with vigorous activity. And vigorous is defined as your heart rate goes up, you begin to sweat, and you are breathing heavily. That's vigorous activity. Their bodies desperately need that. So that energy being penned up in a child is often the cause of some of the behaviors that are challenging us. And we must provide an outlet for that if we respect and value children in our care, which I know we do. Stacey, I would love to hear more from you on this.
Ruby, those are great strategies for getting kids up and moving. I love them. I would also add to make sure that your classroom schedule contains activities that are of a developmentally appropriate length. Our Bureau staffs do observations of children receiving EI services in childcare classrooms, and every once in a while, they'll observe circle times that are 30 plus minutes. And our littlest learners, whether they receive EI supports or not, just can't sit and focus for that long. That's really hard for them. I would suggest breaking scheduled activities up into shorter chunks as a preventative strategy for some of the challenging behavior. I would also suggest structuring your classroom day to alternate sitting and movement activities to naturally offer frequent opportunities for movement throughout the day. For example, you may schedule recess after circle time, so there's a natural opportunity to get those wiggles out.
I just want to interject here quickly and state that, you know, circle times, there is a developmentally appropriate guideline that children under the age of 2 should never have a circle time. Kids 2 years old should have little tiny instances of small group time throughout the day, like a reading of a book or a finger play, where kids can collect and gather if they wish to, but they aren't required to sit for long periods of time. A 3-year-old, 8 minutes, use 8 minutes as your guide. A 4-year-old, use 12 minutes as your guide. I think that it's really essential that we provide fidgets for kids that have, struggles sitting, or all the kids, because why not, keep their hands busy so that their bodies and their minds are actively listening and engaged. Also providing an opportunity for kids to do something else if they're not interested in sitting in circle time, because they're still hearing the content, even if they're sitting and doing a puzzle or reading a book in cozy area. So just some suggestions about that before Chris asks the next question.
Yeah. And, a lot of times when these kids can't get their wiggles out or having a hard time sit still, it leads over to they become emotional. I know my kids, if you're not understanding them or we're trying to get them to sit in one spot too long, they get emotional, especially when they were younger. And we know a lot of these behaviors stem from those emotional and sometimes traumatic responses. So what can providers do to calm this or work with children on self-regulation?
Supporting children who have experienced trauma can be really challenging, and that should be acknowledged. Some of the strategies that Ruby mentioned earlier on building relationships can also support children who have experienced trauma. Children who have experienced trauma need a trusted adult that they can rely on in a predictable and consistent routine. We cannot control the environment children are in when they walk out of our doors, but we can ensure that the environment and routines we offer them are predictable and consistent. Also, and I know this is a big ask when it comes to behaviors that are challenging, but give the child time. Trust doesn't develop overnight, and children need time to know who they can and cannot rely on and trust in their world. Additionally, self-regulation doesn't come naturally to toddlers and preschoolers. Often, it needs to be explicitly taught. Some ways to teach self-regulation include practicing some mindfulness strategies, like deep breathing. And when my daughter, who's 15 now, was little and was experiencing some big feelings, I used to tell her to pretend to smell the flower. So take a deep breath in, smell that flower, and then pretend to blow out the candle. So then take that deep breath out to blow out the candle. And I used to prompt her through that until she was able to calm herself down a little bit so that she could communicate what was really going on. Also, try incorporating some yoga into your classroom routine. Little kids usually love that. opportunity to get upside down and to try different poses. And it's usually a lot of fun for the kids and the adults. And it also gives them the opportunity to kind of slow down and calm down. There's also a number of games that you're probably already playing with kiddos that help teach them self-regulation and control of their bodies, such as Red Light, Green Light, Simon Says, and Freeze Dance. Another strategy is to give kids the opportunity to act out different emotions and responses during pretend play.
Thanks, Stacey. I think those are great recommendations. And I think about all the games that I've played with kids in my entire lifetime. It's just, it's always effective, right? So as providers, I think supporting children around emotions is a key to preventing those behaviors that challenge us so frequently. And first, the children we know to be the feistiest in our environments and our programs, we should be having very intentional conversations with them about planning for those fallout moments. I've asked several providers in my lifetime, well, did you have a conversation with the child? And they just look at me like, what do you mean? Talk to the kid about their emotions or their behavior. So for example, maybe your program puts out calming morning activities like sand and water play or Play-Doh or clay, understanding that the mornings can be very frustrating to young children trying to get up and ready and out of their homes, dealing with things that we might not even know that they have to deal with. During that time, you notice Jake, who escalates very easily in emotional responses, is currently calm and engaged. You sit with him and discuss strategies or a plan for when he isn't feeling calm. You might say something like, Jake, the way you are using these Play-Doh tools with other children is very thoughtful. I can see you are very relaxed right now. Sometimes when you are feeling a big emotion, you have trouble relaxing. Let's think about some strategies we can put into place for you. So that allows Jake the time to think about those strategies. So maybe that includes putting footprints on the floor where he can go stomp out his anger, or putting handprints taped to the wall where he can push against them when frustrated. Maybe it's a silly putty egg that he gets to keep in his cubby and he can grab it when he's having some self-regulation issues, or a special book on emotions if he likes to sit with it when he's feeling upset or uncomfortable. Labeling these feelings and sharing that you also feel them sometimes can help that child feel like he's not like different or unique because he experiences these big emotions. We want to make sure Jake understands that these emotions are normal and manageable. You can also share with him that you are a safe place and can help him breathe through these things if he does that he doesn't want to feel, or help him to sit in those feelings if he needs to sit in those feelings, or help him to understand co-regulation, much like Stacy said, and how that might look when he's feeling like fighting or eloping. And be sure to always ask the verbal child, what do you need from me when these emotions feel huge? And they may have insight you haven't considered. So when Jake's emotional response elevates calmly and privately, when it's safe to do so, label the emotion you think he might be feeling and gently remind him of those strategies that you discussed. Hey, Jake, remember we put that silly putty egg in your cubby? That's just for you. Please be sure to use it when you need it. You might be feeling frustrated if you want to go push against a wall. Eventually, he may learn to cope with on his own with these emotions because you helped him with those essential tools.
A lot of times, providers will skip some of these prevention pieces and may go right to, we need professional interventions for this child. We know that trying these strategies consistently with the children will offset some of those situations. Stacy, can you provide any resources for providers before they reach out to early intervention services? What tools or tricks do the Bureau of Early Intervention and Family Supports have available?
Thanks, Chris. Great question. Early intervention can provide support around behaviors that are challenging by working with the eligible child and their teacher. However, not every child that has behaviors that are challenging will be eligible for early intervention. This can understandably be frustrating for childcare providers who are looking for immediate help. Additionally, evaluating a child to determine if they are eligible for early intervention takes time. For children ages 0 to 3, the EI program has 45 days from the date of the referral to complete the evaluation to determine eligibility, and then, if they're eligible, to develop the Individualized Family Support Plan, or IFSP. For children ages 3 to 5, the EI program has 60 days from the day that the parent consent to evaluate was received to complete the evaluation. And then if the child is eligible, they have an additional 30 days to develop the individualized education plan, or IEP. So in total, around 90 days for preschool. And then if the children are eligible, and once the IFSP or IEP is developed, they have 14 days. This is both for 0 to 3 and for 3 to 5. They have 14 days to start any services that are on the IFSP or IEP. One thing that childcare providers can do if they are deciding to refer to early intervention to support an eligibility determination is to take data and to jot down information on some of the challenging behaviors that they are observing. The EI program should ask for the child care's input as the teacher of the child during the evaluation, and any data that you have collected already could be crucial in making eligibility determinations and also developing an appropriate plan. Another way that you could help speed up the evaluation process for children age 3 to 5 is to help the EI program to obtain parental consent for the evaluation. I said earlier that for kids age 3 to 5, the timeline is 60 days from when the parental consent is obtained. Sometimes there are delays because the parent hasn't provided that consent on the permission to evaluate form. This is understandable as the parent doesn't know the EI program staff or the process. As someone who sees the child in the parent every day, you can be a great help in getting the form signed and the process started. We encourage our EI programs to work with their childcare providers to get the permission to evaluate form signed. Any support you could provide your EI program in that area would be greatly appreciated. While you're waiting for an EI evaluation to be completed, or for children who have been determined to be ineligible for EI, I always recommend the Center on Social and Emotional Foundations for Early Learning, or CEFL, website. They have, and you can Google that, CEFL is C-S-E-F-E-L. They have a lot of wonderful resources to support teachers in building social-emotional skills and preventing challenging behaviors. They have resources that are ready-made for teachers, so all you have to do is kind of print them out and go, or they can be modified as needed. Also, I always highly encourage infant and early childhood mental health consultation. It's a wonderful resource for Keystone Stars providers. They can do an observation and offer suggestions in addressing challenging behaviors.
Thank you, Stacey. That was a plethora of information there. Thank you so much. I just want to weigh in very quickly here. We talked a little bit about trauma-informed and mindfulness practices also being key in this work. At my previous program, we employed a fabulous mindfulness coordinator who worked with our teachers on recognizing ways to integrate mindfulness practices throughout the day with the children, and those teachers also had a lot of opportunity to gain training in recognizing trauma responses in young children and working in a trauma-informed way. So I know many programs do not have that luxury, and I think that it's really important that training become part of this conversation. We want to make this as easy as possible for people, so all of the topics on the PD registry around mindfulness, behavior prevention, trauma-informed care will be easily accessed by going into the PD registry under mindfulness, trauma-informed, and behavior prevention in the drop-down menu. We've created a drop-down menu where all of those trainings are housed together. How to access these trainings will come out in the next registry buzz and early ed news for your convenience. So we'll probably also put them on the podcast page if it's possible to link them there.
Lastly, in this conversation, when a child falls through all these preventative cracks, Stacey, what's the process or resources for providers and families to get a child the help they need from an early intervention perspective?
Thanks, Chris. I would say make that referral to early intervention. And I talked a little bit earlier about how to do that. But one thing that providers can do to facilitate that process is at the point they're making the referral to have an open and honest conversation with the child's parent about what you're seeing and why you feel like a referral to intervention is needed. These conversations can be really, really difficult. Sometimes this might be the first time a parent is hearing that, you know, there's a possible delay. So we acknowledge that these are difficult conversations, but they are essential to the process. And if you'd like some general advice on how to have these conversations with families without sharing child-specific information, reach out to your EI program. They have these conversations with families all the time, and they can help. And they might be able to give you some good advice as you're talking to families. So in terms of referral, anyone can refer a child to early intervention, but EI programs do need written parental consent to proceed with the evaluation and, if eligible, to serve the child. So it helps the EI program if the parents are aware of and in agreement with the referral. Sometimes that is a stopping point for a referral to EI made by a child care or another community partner. The EI program isn't able to reach the parent, or they can reach the parent, but isn't able to obtain consent. So they can't proceed with the evaluation without it. To make a referral, you can contact your local 0-3 infant toddler EI program or 3-5 preschool EI program, depending on the age of the child. We really encourage our EI programs to have relationships with the child cares in their areas. So hopefully you have that contact information available to you. However, if you do not have that contact information, there is another way to make a referral. You can call our Bureau's Connect line, and that number is 1-800-692-7288, or you can email them at connecthelp, connecthelp, at tiu11.org. And Connect helps by directing the referral to the correct EI program. So you don't necessarily need to know the EI program when you call Connect. They will help get you to where you need to be. Lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't say that not all children displaying behaviors that are challenging to adults are going to be eligible for early intervention. EI is wonderful, but it does have a criteria for eligibility. It is important to also connect with your local behavioral health programs to make a referral when a child does not have a delay in development or a disability.
Such great info. Thank you so much, Stacy. This topic and this podcast conversation is so near and dear to my heart, and I know the heart of Okdel. We really want providers to feel supported, and I would be remiss as the Director of Certification Services to not mention that we want to offset some of those potential health and safety issues that can stem from children who may seem to be out of control, and I do have low air quotes going right now, or eloping from programs due to behavioral challenges. This puts everyone at risk, and we hope this podcast assists with some of the complex struggles providers are having. I know staff training on this topic is another essential piece of the puzzle, which I mentioned earlier. A prepared workforce is absolutely necessary. So I'm going to ask Stacy what tools or resources can programs tap into outside of the registry that I just mentioned to get their staff essential behavior prevention training or resources.
Yes, thanks, Ruby. Work with your local EI program. Many programs will go into centers in their area and provide some basic behavioral support training to the staff in that center free of charge. And really, it's in everyone's best interest, both the child care provider and the EI program, to collaborate on these types of trainings so that, you know, the communication is open for around challenging behaviors. Also, you could check out the EDA portal, and that is at www.eita-pa.org. We have a wealth of webinars and job aids and resources on fostering social emotional development and positive behavior supports. And all of those can be accessed free of charge. And some of them you could get Act 48 credits or some professional development credits on those. Those will vary based on the course. So when you're looking on that website, it will tell you for each course, like, of what credits are offered.
Great. Thanks so much, Stacey. So I didn't know if I'd have time to share a really cool story, but I'm going to share it, and it's a little off the cuff, so bear with me. Years ago, this is probably 10 years ago. So the child I'm referencing is probably 15 years old, 14 years old right now. But this child, we'll call him Ty, came to one of my programs having been kicked out of four other programs within a six-month period at the age of four. So Ty came into the program. I put him with a teacher who I knew was great with relationships. The first day, he started standing on tables, jumping up and down, getting other kids to feed into his behavior, laughing at the teacher, throwing things in the classroom, tipping chairs, being super destructive, which is the behavior that was described to us by his mom when she enrolled him. So the teacher that I put him with was really great at acknowledging positives and would instantly point out something somebody else was doing great when this child was doing these behaviors. She would also kind of planned ignore while keeping like standing in a situation where she would keep him from harming others, but still kind of have her back slightly to him so he didn't feel like he was getting a connection from this activity. So what she was great at was connecting with kids. So the minute that she saw him doing anything good or right or within structure, she would sit down with him or she would take notes and talk to him about the notes that she was taking. At first, he was very reluctant, like, why are you writing about me? Or what are you taking? What are you doing? Why are you so close to me? Get away from me. But after a while, he very much warmed up. In the first day, she sat close to him as he was building a structure in the block area, tossing blocks at friends occasionally or kind of knocking down other people's things. But her attention was focused on what he was doing right instead of what he was doing wrong. So she would say to him, hey, Ty, I really love the way that you're building. You are a master builder. You are so good at this. You could teach the other kids in the class how to be a construction worker. You know, let's look at some of these blueprints. Let me show you our construction books. And she got him really excited. After a few minutes of doing this, he started engaging with her and telling her a story about his building. She asked him if she could take some photos of it because she was so impressed at the masterful building that he was doing in the block area. So he allowed her to do that and posed for some pictures with his block structure and loved the attention he was getting for this, as you can imagine, and the connection that she was creating. What he didn't anticipate was coming in the next day to a documentation panel all about him. It was posted on the wall at the welcome center of the classroom, showing exactly the process for his beautiful building and the verbatim story on an index card that Ty told the teacher while he was doing this work. Ty's face lit up with pride. He was so excited. She was showing other parents. She was showing the children. She was like, look at our new kid, Ty's beautiful documentation panel that we created yesterday. Look at this hard work that he does. What a master builder. Really, really just diving into the positives of that situation. You can imagine Ty's pride and how excited he was. Well, he instantly started showing other kids. He was the manager of the block area from that point on, and that was a special role. And they even had a little sign in the block area, manager Ty, you know, with his picture on it. We never, and I am not even exaggerating, had another behavior problem from this little guy because of a 15-minute discussion a teacher had with him in block area and a documentation panel that she took time to put together that valued him and his individuality and the work that he did. that's what prevents behaviors. And I think that that story just touches so many people when they think about that child. And you're thinking about the same child, right? The kid that's throwing things, that's being disruptive, that's laughing at you, that's running around the classroom not listening. There is a solution. We just need to get to the center of what causes these behaviors. So I don't know if either one of you want to react to that at all before we close up here for the day, but I just love that story.
I love that story, and that just attests to the power of an amazing teacher. And so I'm a teacher myself, so that gave me all the feels.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm over here with chills, and every time I tell it in training, people are like, "Oh my gosh, what a great idea!" You know, just thinking about how can I connect with this child instead of focusing on all the things that he's doing inappropriately. We're focusing on the connection, and that needs to be it. Yeah, pretty cool stuff. So, I want to thank you all so deeply for participating today and for listening. If you're out there listening, please know we are not done with this conversation. Our Bureau of Early Learning Policy and Professional Development is working on some really cool resources for providers on this topic. And when they are ready, we will have a part two of this discussion with some other special guests. So, Chris, you did a fantastic job facilitating this conversation. We are so grateful to our partner bureaus and Stacy for joining in this very important conversation. Thank you, Stacy, for your intellect and your knowledge on this conversation. I also want to thank you all for tuning in to ask that you share our podcast with your colleagues and even families, because this topic will serve them well, and these preventative strategies can be done at home as well. Lastly, a super big shout out to our behind the scenes supporters at the PA Key for helping us get these podcasts edited and published and shared with all of you. Thanks to Colin and Kelsey and Mary for your professionalism and always speedy support. And I also want to thank the PA PD registry team for throwing together that drop menu and that list for us with like no time at all. They were done and had that for us as a resource. So I love that. I hope you all have a really wonderful summertime. And remember, Chris, where is our RA account for the podcast? Can people access that?
Yep. It'll be listed in the description of this podcast episode.
Great. And we give you that RA account so you can give us suggestions and ideas for other podcasts you want to hear about, you know, whether it's from certification services or other bureaus within OCDEL. We can always have more special guests. We encourage you to share. We are thankful that you're here, and we will see you all in August with our next hot topic. So take good care, and we're signing out here at the Confluence. Thanks so much.